Good morning, everybody. I'm Marla Dubinsky from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and I'm delighted to be joined by my colleagues, Dr. Millie Long and Angelina Collins, who is joining us this morning. Today we're going to be talking about shedding light on bowel urgency, presenting the latest data, and initiating conversations in Crohn's disease management. Just to note, this educational activity is supported by an educational grant from Eli Lilly, and CME Outfitters is a joint accreditation provider, and as such develops and certifies continuing education activities for the team, by the team, including our program today. I also want to encourage everyone to join us today in our live Twitter conversation at CME Outfitters. We'll be monitoring the Twitter feed and responding to your tweets as they come in. Also, I want to remind our audience that the iPads and online platforms you're using today allows you to save your slides, take notes on the slides, answer polling questions, and send us your questions. So please log in and interact with us. So maybe, Angelina, you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I'm Angelina Collins. I'm a nurse practitioner at the University of California, San Diego, and I'm in the IBD Center. I work alongside Dr. Sid Singh and Dr. Bridget Boland.
Amazing. Thank you. Millie?
I'm Millie Long. I'm at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in our IBD Center there.
Great. And we've got an online audience as well. So hello to everybody who's looking in from virtual world. So let's start by reviewing our objective. So the first objective is to recognize the frequency of bowel urgency in patients with Crohn's and the impact on their quality of life. The second one is to incorporate assessments for bowel urgency as part of thorough symptom evaluation for patients with Crohn's disease. And third, to engage patients in open communication about their bowel urgency as part of shared decision-making in order to improve clinical outcomes. So before we get started, we're going to ask the audience a question. How often do you incorporate bowel urgency assessments into your evaluation of patients with Crohn's disease? A, always, B, usually, C, seldom, and D, never. So let's answer the question.
Music this morning.
Very nice.
All right, thank you. So Millie, I'm going to turn it over to you. You're going to walk us through some of the important data around symptom impact in Crohn's disease.
Great, yes. Looking forward to this discussion because I think, at least in my practice, it seems that people attribute urgency with ulcerative colitis and don't necessarily think about this in the setting of Crohn's disease. But I just want to emphasize how many patients with Crohn's disease are truly impacted by this symptom. And to start, we'd like to hear from one of my patients.
This is the chief thing that dictates my day. I had several problems and occurrences over the weekend. Even today was an interesting morning. But ultimately, you know, urgency, so with my urgency comes fecal incontinence, because I've had several surgeries that have compromised, my anatomy. And so we've worked together on that and I've put some things in place, I think, that help with that. But ultimately, you know, like I don't go to the gym anymore. I work out from home. I was tired of running to the bathroom or having to stop what I was doing. It impacts, you know, carpool. Happened to carpool one day last week, and I'm stuck in the carpool lane with my 10-year-old who can't get out of the car yet. And so a lot of times with my issues come accidents, which, you know, is very, you know, demoralizing to be, you know, a 48-year-old woman who, you know, as a wife and a mother and has a career, and I have this thing that I carry on me every day. You know, so it really does. I have a change of clothes in the car. You know, I've had problems at church. I've had problems on a plane. I've had, you know, it is top of mind for me every single day that I wake up. It's a fear and a worry for me. And it's just something that I've come to live with as part of my normal.
So I think that's very impactful. And unfortunately, Christina is not alone in terms of her symptoms. And so when we talk about unmet needs in Crohn's disease, there are really several aspects, risk stratification, individualized therapy selection, that we do, unfortunately, have a therapeutic ceiling. We know not as much about the sequencing of our therapies. And then there's certainly special populations where we need more data in terms of truly understanding optimized treatment responses. We're making progress, but we're not totally there yet in improved monitoring and tight control. And certainly we need to better understand therapeutic de-escalation strategies. All of these are an important aspect of caring for patients with Crohn's disease, and is often where we focus. But remember that for our patients, the area of utmost importance is really restoring quality of life. And that's where urgency comes in. So patients with Crohn's disease really experience persistent bowel urgency, even in the presence of advanced therapies. My patient, Christina, is endoscopically healed on advanced therapies, yet you hear her story of the impact of continued urgency. So if you look on the left, you'll note that at enrollment at 6 months, at 12 months, patients with Crohn's disease who really reported bowel urgency, who are on an advanced therapy, certainly those rates are lower than those on the right for those who are not on a TNF, but still quite prevalent. And then when you look on the right, you can see percentages. And so we're really talking about a fifth of our patients at any time with worsening bowel urgency symptoms. So when we think about what symptoms truly impact our patients the most, when you actually do surveys, we'll show you some of these data, pain is very impactful for our patients, fatigue, and bowel urgency. Certainly pain may be something that we readily and routinely ask about in clinic and we really try to address proactively, but I would argue that bowel urgency needs to be in the same fashion. Certainly there are multiple aggravators, they're relentless and unpredictable symptoms, and I think as you heard from my patient, the unpredictability of urgency really impacts individual patients on a daily basis, and there's certainly a far-reaching negative impact. That fact that a patient needs to constantly plan and adapt, you know, carry a change of clothes in the car, we'll show you some data on wearing pads or diapers, creates uncertainty and anxiety. And there can be mental health impacts, certainly relationship closeness. We'll show you some data surrounding how this affects intimacy, work or school performance. You know, this can really affect someone's trajectory and choices through their educational achievement. And social isolation and stigma, you know, in many instances with this particular symptom, someone may not leave the house or may not choose to go and engage socially. So all of this becomes really important in terms of understanding the context of this symptom and the impact it has not only on our patients, but on everyone around them. So what really is the most important target? You know, improving quality of life. But I would argue that quality of life includes this symptom, urgency. Pain and urgency are the two symptoms patients really hope to control when they think about the word remission, complete resolution of symptoms. When you ask patients, it's not that normal colonoscopy that is of utmost importance. I think from our perspective, we certainly want to control inflammation. It's certainly one of my goals. I treat to that target of endoscopic improvement. But yet, we really need to understand that from the patient's perspective, it's these quality of life factors that are most important. So we really need to have dual targets. There's this cycle of adaptation to a new normal. And you heard this from Christina, constant planning and adaptation to cope with symptoms, which then leads to increased anxiety. And we know the impact anxiety can have on our patients. And then getting caught in a vicious cycle with worsening symptoms. And again, that trifecta of bowel urgency, fatigue, and pain that really impact our patients on a daily basis. Interestingly and importantly, the Confide survey, I think, was eye-opening for many of us in the field. This was a nice study that looked both in the United States and in Europe in terms of truly understanding the proportion of patients with various symptoms. And as you look here, bowel urgency is incredibly prevalent. And in terms of ever or current. And I think that's what struck me, is that I understand, you know, during flares, certainly someone has a history of having bowel urgency, but look how many patients are living with this symptom on a current, regular basis. So obviously this is incredibly prevalent for our patients. When you look amongst Crohn's patients, again, remember that we understand and are starting to do better in ulcerative colitis, but in Crohn's disease patients, when you look at bowel urgency-related accidents, and when you combine the green and the light blue, that means they're having these symptoms at least once per month. The majority of our patients here in the U.S. are having bowel urgency accidents at least once per month. It is really just as much an issue in our Crohn's disease population as it is in our ulcerative colitis population. And I wanted to direct your attention to the bottom kind of rows where we're looking at diaper, pad, or other protection use. And when you glance there, you see that 66% of patients are requiring some sort of protection at least once per month. Obviously, that has a huge impact on quality of life. Here again, kind of further data from the Confide survey. 81% of U.S. and 85% of European healthcare providers, that's us, we did not rank bowel urgency among the symptoms most reported by patients. And when we rated this, we talked about diarrhea, we talked about abdominal pain, we talked about blood and stool. But yet, from the patient perspective, we really need to consider bowel urgency. And in fact, when you also look at healthcare provider data, really, we don't do a good job of proactively discussing bowel urgency. This can be a sensitive topic, and patients may not bring it up unless asked, and there's some embarrassment associated with this in some instances. And so the idea of us being proactive becomes very important in terms of the management of our patients. Why do we not discuss this? When you look at the survey, unfortunately, a small percentage of healthcare providers thought it was not relevant. But when you really look at the most common reason, it's that we expect the patient to bring it up if there's a problem with this, to bring it up proactively. Perhaps we didn't have enough time, or the patient may seem uncomfortable, or we are uncomfortable with this discussion. I would argue that none of those are valid reasons. We really need to be proactive about discussing this important symptom and prevalent symptom in our patient population. So why do patients not want to discuss this? I think they want to, but they may be embarrassed. Embarrassment was the most common reason for patient discomfort in being proactive with this discussion. Only about 40% of U.S. and 27% of European patients were completely comfortable discussing bowel urgency with their healthcare provider. So what this means is that the majority of patients may not be proactively bringing this up, so the prevalence, obviously, in our clinic populations is likely higher than we're anticipating. And when you look otherwise, making them nervous, the anxiety associated with this, other rationale for the not bringing up urgency. Unfortunately, there's a reasonable percentage, kind of the second down, as you can see in the U.S., about the concern that, well, the healthcare provider can't help me anyway. But I think in many instances we can, and that's why we need to bring this up. So, what is the impact of inflammatory bowel disease and urgency on daily activity? Certainly, patients really limit their physical activity. The majority of patients do. And about a third of patients reported avoiding running or jogging. Actually, you heard my patient Christina say that as well. And what are the reasons? Mostly fatigue, concerns about disease flare-ups, but that increased toilet urgency, really restricting the patient to the home, to be near the bathroom facilities, so that they're not out and enjoying things like exercise or daily activity. Or perhaps they've accommodated their schedule. My patient Christina built a home gym, you know, so that she could have that ready access. So this becomes important for us to ask about. Physical activity, as we know, can be linked to improved mental health and various other aspects. So when you look specifically at rationale and reasons for avoiding activity in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, sometimes it's related to, you know, the underlying pain, the abdominal pain or the joint pain. Fatigue is probably the most common, particularly in Crohn's disease. But when you look, just the fourth over is actually bowel urgency. So yet again, its impact on our patients' daily lives. So how do they adapt? Running and jogging, that is the highest in terms of what people avoid, potentially gym exercises or classes. These are activities that patients may have used to enjoy that they are no longer participating in. So sexual health is another area that urgency can certainly impact. Sexual functioning, satisfaction, and drive are really negatively impacted by IBD and can impact quality of life. So this was a survey of gastroenterologists, and 70% never or rarely asked patients about sexual dysfunction. 75% did not change a treatment if a patient reported sexual dysfunction. So what are the barriers here? Lack of knowledge, certainly, lack of experience, lack of time, but you'll also see embarrassment there. And so this, again, is an area where we may be able to really truly improve the quality of life of our patients by simply asking, making appropriate referrals, and providing expertise. So the impact of bowel urgency on sexual activity is also described here. The bowel urgency itself, as you can see on the top row, the patient-provided reasons for avoiding or decreasing sexual activity really quite elevated in the 30 to 40% range. When you add in fear of bowel urgency-related accidents or fear of bowel movement accidents, that's essentially the entire top of this survey. So this is really the number one reason. Certainly other aspects of underlying inflammatory bowel disease, whether that's abdominal pain, you know, or other characteristics. But as you can see, this association is real. Patients who, and you look on the right, you can see that when patients were asked, did you avoid or decrease sexual activity in the last 3 months, so very current assessment, that the majority, 63% in the U.S., said yes, associated with that and their bowel urgency and inflammatory bowel disease. So this is a study that we did from UNC in a patient cohort called IBD Partners. And what IBD Partners is it's an online survey that patients complete. They complete surveys every 6 months. It's longitudinal follow-up. And really, it's focused on patient-reported outcomes. But one of the advantages here is patients may feel comfortable in their own homes, on their computer or device, really being honest about some of these symptoms. And so we evaluated a specific instrument, the UNRS, which we'll talk to you a little bit about, but a very nice urgency, simple assessment tool that actually is very friendly for use in clinical practice. And we asked patients, both with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, about their not only whether urgency was present with this tool, but also the degree of urgency. And so in this very large study where we had, over 1,500 patients with Crohn's disease, you see that 58% of patients reported bowel urgency. And while we did see a higher rate among those with active Crohn's disease as compared to those in remission, 87% versus 48%, this means that half of our patients who are in remission are still experiencing bowel urgency. This population certainly had individuals with prior surgery, about half, and, you know, obviously disease that had potentially been very active in the past. When you look at the characteristics of those who had no bowel urgency, it was patients, potentially there was a somewhat lower rate of prior GI surgery. The other characteristics were fairly comparable. So when we kind of dug into the data a little bit more, we also did associations with individuals who had bowel urgency versus not and looked at various other quality of life factors. We use something called NIH Promise Measures, which are validated tools that are able to look at domains and actually have an inherent comparison to the general population as well. And so amongst patients on the left with bowel urgency in blue, you'll see that a significantly worse social satisfaction. This is the ability to go out and enjoy life socially. Fatigue, sleep disturbance. Remember, there's nothing like having to wake up with urgency to disrupt your sleep patterns. Pain interference, anxiety, and depression. So essentially every PRO we looked at was worsened by bowel urgency. On the right, you'll see that we actually chose patients who are all in remission with Crohn's disease, and yet you still see an impact on social satisfaction, fatigue, pain interference, anxiety. So yet again, just demonstrating some of the impact of this symptom on our patient population. So just to summarize, and I think we'll have a great discussion about much of this later, that urgency is prevalent. I think we've shown that amongst a number of patient cohorts. That embarrassment is a common reason that patients avoid bringing this up. So it's something that I would argue that we as healthcare providers need to be very proactive in assessing. Almost half of patients report using pads, liners, or diapers at least once a week. And actually, it's much more than half when you talk about once a month, so this is affecting our patients very regularly. Patients frequently avoid physical and social activities due to bowel urgency, and urgency is the most commonly reported reason for decreasing sexual activity. So I think this is sobering in terms of the impact of urgency.
Yeah, thank you, Millie. I think you made it clear that we're probably not assessing enough the symptom burden of urgency and its real impact beyond just even yes or no, which is what I'll get into now, is talking about how do we assess it. And there's some really good questions that I know your section is going to address, because everyone is interested in, well, how do you manage it? Mm-hmm. And how do we measure? So I'm going to talk a little bit about measuring. First, we have a question, which is, which of the following assessments here listed actually captures bowel urgency impact in patients with Crohn's disease. So first, A is the Crohn's Disease Activity Index, B is the Harvey-Bradshaw Index, C is the Urgency Numeric Rating Scale, or UNRS, D is the IBDQ, which is the quality of life metric, and E is I don't know. So let's vote. All right, so we'll get to those at the end, and we'll see how the responses line up. So I think before we even talk about how do we measure it, how about how do we define it? And when you look through studies that have mentioned or looked at urgency, what this slide is showing you, and this was just published recently actually, is that there's essentially no definition for bowel urgency that is agreed upon or thought to be something we can standardize or uniform to be used in clinical trials. And we'll talk about, obviously, the urgency NRS, which is move the game to beyond yes or no. But even when you look at the simple clinical colitis activity index, which is one of these clinical ways that you're assessing symptoms in UC, you can see really there's not even those that use that assessment in their studies really don't even mention urgency. And most of the time when you're talking about symptom burden, urgency is not on the table. So I think elevating the game and understanding that there's really no definitions of urgency, even if they mention it at any level in the use of existing assessments or just talking about it. So I think, what are some of the barriers to identifying bowel urgency? I think where people are maybe mixing things is that I always say that my patients who have 3 to 4 stools that they can make it to the toilet, there's no urgency, they're able to have control, is far better for patients than even having one stool that is associated with urgency. Because I think we often think that stool frequency, and you saw, we listed, wow, diarrhea, number of stools a day, that's in every Epic note or every, EHR note. but it's not common that we're actually, even in our templates, asking about urgency. Mm-hmm. So it's easily missed, and I think we're not asking the next question, right? We're always just asking yes, no, or number of stools, for example. And as you know, you noted that individuals are not talking about it, but also we know that 55% of patients who report urgency have no change in stool frequency, which is, I think, really an important point for everyone to take to their clinic and recognize that the number of stools do not equate to bowel urgency. And I think that's sort of important when you think about it. And when we talk about commonly used CD disease activity indices, I just mentioned in the question, but these are, you know, the CDAI is what we're currently using predominantly in clinical trials, and you're very familiar with the Crohn's Disease Activity Index if you know how, if you've seen how the clinical trials have been run. Harvey-Bradshaw Index is something that you do as a point in time. CDAI is a 7-day, based on a 7-day recall, in essence, or if you're prospectively knocking, noting down the 7 days leading up to a study visit, or the Harvey-Bradshaw, as I noted, which is a one-time indice. The IBDQ is really about the quality of life and sleep and fatigue and some subtle ways of asking how your life is impacted by some of your symptoms. And the PRO2, which is really just the CDAI minus everything but abdominal pain and stool frequency. So in our new Crohn's disease trials of late, PRO2, and you'll see today at some of the plenary talking about in Crohn's disease studies, the PRO2, but essentially when you look back, it ended up that there was a concern that general well-being, which is on the CDAI, which has a high weight, was almost dominantly too subjective for clinical trials. P.S., we're constantly going back. Europe wants the CDAI and U.S. PRO2 or vice versa, and we're not even able to have sort of a compliant way of looking across this, across all clinical trials. So it's bouncing back and forth. The point is that none of them ask about urgency. I think that's sort of the key point around it in terms of flat out urgency severity, which is really what the urgency numeric rating scale really talks about. As noted, they don't ask about severity. The impact in the IBDQ on quality of life, and you could sort of subtly look at the role of urgency on some of your quality of life metrics, but they're not actually directly asking about the severity of this, of your urgency. So it lines up perfectly for what is the urgency numeric rating scale and how do we measure urgency. Now, this is a 10-point scale, 0 being no urgency, 10 being the worst possible urgency. And also it's evaluating based on recall in the last 7 days. It's used in clinical trials, and we'll get to that in a moment when I show you what are some of the meaningful impacts. But this is, again, noting that higher scores equate to higher bowel urgency severity. It is asking in the last 24 hours, how severe has your bowel urgency been? Either none or to the extreme worst possible. Really, the first therapeutic trial that we had that actually validated and put the UNRS into our mindset was the mirikizumab trial with ulcerative colitis, but the MIRI trial for Crohn's disease also looks at it, and it was the first trial where we actually defined bowel urgency remission and actually looked at the data showing that there was a difference between, obviously, placebo and active drug at being able to improve urgency, so a response or an improvement, meaningful improvement, as well as bowel urgency remission, and I'll get into that in just a moment. Other trial with upadacitinib did ask about urgency, but it was a yes-no, and to me, it was actually more about tenesmus than it was actually about urgency. So even the way that it's worded, it's not even assessing severity. Again, this is a whole other level of understanding that we are very, abdominal pain, yes, no. Well, do we ask location, right? We ask how long it lasts. We ask, you know, does it radiate? We're very good at asking around abdominal pain, how severe is it, mild, moderate, severe. But yet with urgency, we tend to just say yes, no. All right, well, let's move on. You know, let's get your calprotectin and let's get your colonoscopy booked. And the patient really wants to tell you that all the things that they're not doing because of the urgency or how severe it is really is how much it's impacting their quality of life. So when you look at some of the consensus and some of the guidelines that are out there, the second nursing echo consensus statement was really focused on understanding our patients need to be near toilets. They need to, we need to be asking about urgency and really bringing it up in proactive way, because Millie showed that providers such as ourselves are not even listing it as the top three symptoms that our patients are bothered by. Yet we know that patients, it is the top, one of the top symptoms, but they think that it's embarrassing, as you noted. But also they just feel that maybe it's just me. My doctor didn't ask me about it, so I'm assuming maybe this is just my problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know that this is something that, 50% of patients are wearing a diaper at least once a week. So obvious, and those that responded to the survey, granted, that's the anonymous confide survey data. But you showed in music as well, similarly, when you ask patients to describe their symptoms, they are suffering in silence, and we know that. And there is FDA guidance, which we're happy to see based on the UC study. But now imagine, based on what we're finding out from the UC, the Crohn's disease studies, especially with mirikizumab, we're seeing that urgency is as important to a Crohn's patient as it is to a UC patient. And that PROs, such as abdominal pain in particular, but that's already part of the, of the CDI, but the CDI doesn't ask about severity of abdominal pain. It's a yes, no. Did you experience it every day leading up to my study visit or when we asked them for recall? Again, patient-reported outcome of urgency and abdominal pain actually is more about the severity than it is the presence or absence of it. And I think, and it gives guidance as to how we should be thinking about it. So, as noted, the assessment of bowel urgency through patient-reported outcome tools, as noted, there are some pathways that the our industry partners and those CROs that are in the business of developing these PROs are following what is needed to actually be part of clinical trial and thought to be a validated metric to be used either in the clinic or in the trial. And the three PROs really that at least mention urgency are the two before the UNRS, the 6CD, which is through Alimentive, which was a patient-reported outcome metric, which again looks at symptom and impact questionnaire for Crohn's disease, the Crohn's disease PRO symptom signs and symptoms, that's through Peter Higgins, that's a diary, and that again asks the question around urgency, but it does not highlight the symptom severity and measurement of the severity. And also some of these are duplicative, sort of double barrel questions sometimes, and they don't actually get to the severity question. So as we think about urgency, and I noted that that's the question, which is how severe was your urgency, and again, defined as sudden or immediate need, because you have to define that in a PRO. You actually have to tell a patient or ask them what exactly you're talking about in order for them to appropriately measure. Now, one other thing we know is that when you ask patients to rate the global severity rating scale of their condition, meaning mild, moderate, severe, that rating scale more closely matches urgency than it does abdominal pain and stool frequency. Meaning if you ask a patient to define their disease as mild, moderate, or severe, and then you match it with a numeric scale of something, whether it's urgency, whether it's stool or abdominal pain rating scale, or those are sort of the aspects of it, it more closely correlates with urgency. So again, we're missing the point, right? Because we're so focused on the wrong things. Millie showed the slide where patients' normal colonoscopy does not allow you to live your best life in the minds of our patients. But what we need to do as educators and clinicians is connect the two. Yes. So first we have to understand that per the STRIDE guidelines, you want rapid symptom resolution. Then you want objective metrics such as biomarkers like calprotectin or CRP, and then you want quality of life, and you want normalization of endoscopy. We set the bar quite high at endoremission. But the point being is that we believe that if we can take patients to endonormalization, they will have benefits that are not just in that short term, but long-term, which is disease modification. When patients are sick, the last thing they want to know is in 2 years from now whether I'm going to go to the OR. And that's what we've been talking about. The role of treat to target is so that you reduce complications, hospitalizations, and surgeries. The patients just actually want to not have to wear a diaper. And we're talking about normalization of colonoscopy. So I get it.
Yeah.
And that's the disconnect, that we're not sort of walking through or planting the breadcrumbs, that getting there is important. And that's why we want to try and achieve and really focus on the symptom burden for our patients. So the UNRS is really the first step at being able to quantify the impact of urgency on our patients. Now, as part of the psychometric evaluations, as we're doing the qualitative research around the UNRS, it was really to show that it's responsive to change. And this is just showing at baseline is the urgency rating scales. Light blue means before you got drug, before you got Miri, and then at 12 weeks of getting drug. And the great thing is that the light blue, which is at the beginning, you could see that more patients fall from 5 to 10 on the scale when you start a drug. And then when you look at induction, this is not at a year, but at induction, you could see that the dark blue, which is the responsiveness, is more towards those that are 4, 3, 2, 1, and 0. And you could see the percentage of individuals who reported 0, which is stool, which is no bowel urgency. So I think seeing that it's responsive, but also making sure that individuals understand the question we're asking is also part of when you do psychometric evaluation to make sure that it's resonating and it's actually an answerable question. And a lot of individuals will ask when we're presenting this data, what's a meaningful improvement to patients? Like, what defines that if I have a change from 9 to 8, is that a meaningful change? That doesn't appear to be a meaningful change. Some of our psychometric, this is from UC actually, but some of our psychometric newer data from Crohn's does, believe it or not, show that a score, a change of 1 is impactful, but not as meaningful when it relates to really impacting their quality of life, and that is at least a 3-point change. So if you have an individual and you put the UNRS in your Epic note or your template or your whatever EHR you use, and you score it, and patient says was last time you saw them it was 10 and now it's 7, that's a meaningful change for our patients. Obviously, we want to do better. And what your section is going to tell us is that, and this is what all the questions are about, is it always driven by inflammation? And my favorite topic is to say, absolutely not, and we just don't understand, and we need to understand the pelvic floor and how we can actually address brain-gut dysregulation in its highest form there when it comes to urgency for our patients. So in summary, why bowel urgency matters? Well, we know bowel urgency is one of the most important symptoms for patients, has a significant impact on the patient, their loved ones, mm-hmm. It's not just the patient, their quality of life. Mm-hmm. We're not typically asking enough about it. We also know that it has become increasingly recognized in guidelines, and rumor has it that the ACG updated guidelines will be in the fall of 2024,
yes,
I believe.
October
of 2024, how exciting. Hopefully bowel urgency is part of that guideline. Okay. And the UNRS is going to be a way for us to move beyond yes or no and really understand the severity. So Angelina is going to walk us through sort of the real meat and potatoes of this is how do we measure it, how do we fix it, and what are the ways to approach it?
Well, thank you both because you set the stage perfectly with thinking about we're not talking about this enough. How do we make this conversation a more normalized conversation in clinic? And then part of the thing, as was well explained, is that part of the reason we're not asking is because we don't know what to do when someone says, yes, I am having urgency, and then we're supposed to give options. We're supposed to give some solutions, and yet we're not quite sure. So we will hope that this will explain more.
I think our patient has to feel like that physician is also their support person. You know, yeah. I mean, it's the things that you don't have on a result page. It's the intangible things that are really like this urgency problem. It is on top of my mind every single day when I wake up, every single day, and it stays there. It's with me every day. And, you know, I did a lot of research trying to understand what my options were, but a lot of patients don't do that, and they really lean on the physician or their provider to help guide them And so, yeah, there are tools and resources, but there's a lot of education that needs to go along with that for the patient so that they understand what that looks like. As providers, you need a toolkit for patients, and you can really kind of pivot on, you know, somebody like me who's going to do a lot of research and ask a lot of questions, or who has a family member or a loved one who's being a healthcare advocate for me when I couldn't be. But a lot of patients don't have that. But even if you're coming up with, you know, treatments, whether it's medications, whether it's physical therapy, whether it's all the things that we've talked about, the patient is never going to get to that point if you're not having the conversation with them and giving them a safe space to talk about their feelings around urgency and letting them talk about that. If you're not bringing it up, chances are they're not going to. They're just not.
She brings up, again, the really good point that it's our job as providers to ask the question and ask that tough question. And I think in some ways I honestly just try to normalize it. And when a patient's uncomfortable, and sometimes they'll just lead with, some of my other patients have mentioned they're having urgency. Is that something that you're experiencing as well? Or is that something that is challenging for you? Or however it's phrased is more just to start that conversation and really try to make it as safe a space as possible, since we know our patients are embarrassed. Yet they don't need to be, since it is such a widespread problem, and especially even in Crohn's disease. I think Christina was really, I mentioned this earlier before we started, I think she was really brave to be able to put herself out there and be willing to be videotaped and mention some of these things, because I think even that's the hard part too. But the patients, time and time again, you know, Dr. Long's response was, our patients will talk about it if they think that we can help other people. And it was a really great way to put it, that our patients are willing to talk about it because there's a greater good and they want us to understand that. So here's another case, a patient case of Victoria. She's a 29-year-old woman. She was diagnosed with colonic Crohn's disease and perianal phenotype 3 years ago. Her current treatment is infliximab, 5 milligrams per kilogram every 8 weeks. So some of the things that you're uncovering while you're having your conversation with her, she says, I worry about access to a bathroom at work and have cut back my hours. So she's making concessions as to how to manage her workday. She also says, I've stopped going out with friends and family if I'm unsure of the bathroom situation. Again, I think this is something we frequently hear of, or even people that avoid it altogether. Interestingly, I'm sure you both had the same situation as I did during COVID, where some of our patients almost breathed a sigh of relief that they didn't have to make social plans. They didn't have to. There was no expectation of going out in the early days of those of the pandemic, because they just were like, oh, it's great. I can work from home now. Oh, it was interesting. And she also says, I haven't been able to make it to the bathroom in time twice this month and started carrying extra clothes. And I think a lot of our patients do that, and they have a whole bag that, you know, it has a tool. Their toolkit is, you know, plastic bag and diapers and underwear and pads and all of these things, and many of our patients do this. So when we're thinking through how to set up with our patients, how do we think about what the goals would be and what can we do to help our patients? And maybe there's some simple interventions that need to happen, like identifying the ideal number of hours or shift length, what time of the day maybe would be best for them to have their shift, and seeing if we can work with their employee to help with that, and developing a work bathroom plan. And sometimes that has a bit to do with again, timing of the day, or how they're timing things like coffee. Some of my patients obviously don't want to have coffee before they're, you know, have to run out the door, or other things like that. Identifying rescue interventions to support social and family activities. So what can they do? Is there a safe way, or is there a safe person within their family that they might be able to talk with as well that can help them in times of in times of situations where there is urgency? And identifying potential bowel urgency triggers. So this is the big feature, and trial intervention to improve them. And we're going to go through some interventions as well. So what do we do for bowel urgency? What are some, are there, I think this is going to be, are there tips and tricks that you guys use, or do you want to?
Well, I think I'll start, and I know Marla will weigh in as well. You know, one of the first things is that we have to decide, is this inflammatory mediated, or are there other structural or functional issues? And so if she came to me with these complaints, one of the first things I would be thinking is, well, you know, obviously rectal inflammation and Crohn's disease. She could have some sphincter issues associated with perianal disease. So I really need to reassess where she is objectively first to help me to understand if I need to alter her treatment plan. I mean, frankly, she's on infliximab 5 mg per kg every 8 weeks, and with perianal disease, I often need to target pretty high levels, so I'm wondering if she's a little under-treated at this point. And so I typically start there, and then if I confirm there's no inflammation, then pivot to alternate treatment plans. I don't know if you do the same, Marla.
Yeah, I think what we know, and I showed, you know, I talked about stool frequency doesn't equate to urgency necessarily, is that 100%, you need to rule out inflammation, mm-hmm. and then when you have, you know, you feel you've reached your target of mm-hmm. whatever defined, whether histo or not, there is some, like, I think Dave Rubin presented that some histo activity may be associated with ongoing sort of issues around urgency and compliance of the rectum and stuff, but that hasn't been fully sort of vetted, and I think with intestinal ultrasound, we may be able to get better ideas around bowel mm-hmm. functioning, but you can't see the rectum with intestinal ultrasound. So I think if you've endoscopically feel you've reached your target, you've got deep remission, that's when you start really digging into the brain-gut or the mind-body concept and understanding the role of the pelvic floor mm-hmm. in people who have had long-standing uncontrolled ulcerative colitis, and when you start getting the centralization of anxiety and mm-hmm. stress and worry, I mean, she told us that she wakes up in the morning.
Oh, yeah. It's the first thing she thinks about.
And she thinks about it all day.
Yeah. Right.
How are you able to focus on other things? And half the time you understand you're sort of so anxious, and literally mm-hmm. I think your sphincter
yes.
is overworked. And like any muscle, it just gets tired. And I think that's where you'll go into a little bit more. Are there certain a diet? There are some things like, you know, caffeine or what, you know, there are different mm-hmm. things you can talk to your, like us, well caffeinated.
Yes.
The DDW diet. And yes. I think that, you know, part of it is understanding their diet, their lifestyle, and really adapting. But I think this is where you bring your behavioral health friends mm-hmm. into the mix.
Yeah. Well, and other considerations that aren't necessarily there and you see from a Crohn's disease perspective is many of my patients have had 1-2 small bowel resections.
Yes.
They may have a very normal rectum,
yes.
but they may have urgency. And so we also need to think about things like bile acid malabsorption.
Yes.
You know, and I know you're going to go into yeah. a lot of the details of what we can consider, and hopefully our participants, both online and in person, will leave here with like a toolkit
exactly.
of things they can assess and treat. But I think the key take-home point is assess for inflammation,
yes.
reach your target, assess for other cofactors like, mm-hmm. You know, bile acid malabsorption, and then modify your treatment plan.
Yeah.
I think where we doubled down on the fact that you don't need rectal inflammation to be present for urgency is in the Crohn's data. Because
right.
when I first saw the Crohn's data, I didn't, like, you almost think there must have been, you see patients who answered the survey, right? In your mind, there is just, you ask it, but it's definitely not in your mind logically, anatomically.
Right.
But that's why I mentioned mm-hmm. urgency in a Crohn's patient, you must start looking for emotional and psychological support and bile acid diarrhea and diet and things mm-hmm. like that, because in the absence of rectal inflammation, you need to think outside the box.
Yep.
So you'll take us
yep.
through the box and thinking outside of it.
We're gonna walk through all of that. But I love this is all foreshadowing on what's to come in the next few slides, so it'll be hopefully very helpful. So with Victoria, you're exactly as Dr. Long pointed out, number one is to investigate without question what's really, you know, what's going on to help us understand what's driving at symptoms. So in this situation, we're doing everything. So we're checking an infliximab drug concentration level. I think there's different, the conversation today will not be about what the goals are, I think, as to what you would look for. I think five, you know, for me,
five historically in the literature is the goal, but I would argue, and Marla would argue, that it should be higher than that.
I would argue the same. So I'm absolutely with you guys on that. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Her CRP is elevated. You might notice fecal calprotectin's elevated. Stool culture and pathogens were negative. C. difficile was negative. Ova and parasites were negative. So even before she gets to the colonoscopy, you have a clue because those labs come back first, right? And you have ideas already. You're thinking there is some mild inflammation going on. And in fact, her colonoscopy confirms that there is some mild Crohn's disease still ongoing. But it's mild. But I think here, this is a very nice way of just very simply approaching how would you approach bowel urgency and where do you sort of start and then where can we go with it. So starting at the very top, number one is the assessment. We've talked about this a lot. Ask the questions, ask the hard question, because you may be either pleasantly surprised by an answer that says, no, I'm not having any urgency, but more often than not, there is likely to be urgency in our patients. The second part is the inflammation controlled or not controlled? And this part is important because that's going to, you may be using your toolkit in multiple ways, but first and foremost is, you know, thinking in terms of what are we doing on the medication side of things and what are we doing also in other areas. So we need to be doing both of those things. So when there is inflammation, like in Victoria's case, there is still some very mild inflammation. You know that her calprotectin's elevated, her CRP's elevated, and that there's room, I think, I would argue for sure that there's room for optimization of her infliximab, and so in fact, that was the route we were taking. However, in addition to that, I think there's room for other options as well, right? And this is when we go into the pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic interventions down below. There's things that we can add in as well. So under dietary modifications, this particular topic won't get into too much of the FODMAPs or the low FODMAPs diet, but these has been used by many people to try to limit, in particular, certain sugars, and fructans especially can be associated with urgency. So that may be one simple thing, because I think if anyone has tried to follow a low FODMAPs diet, it's really hard. Mm-hmm. Coming from Southern California, when I think about avocados, just one item on the list, it's like it's very hard to have like, you know, an eighth of an avocado. You're like, that's like one bite of guacamole for me, you know? So it's very hard to do things like that, and it may be very challenging for patients. But I think in that sense, if we ask them to just look at, maybe we can just like look at fruit and see how that might be impacting, and maybe that would work for that and removing, say, high fructans. What about medications as well? And then addressing anorectal dysfunction, and obviously the psychosocial support is quite is a huge part of it as well. So we're going to go through some of these and thinking in terms of what to come to next. So that brings us to the topic of antidiarrheals. This can be a really valuable therapy. I will mention that I have a patient with Crohn's disease, long-standing Crohn's disease. She's in her 60s. And when we did a very simple intervention, which was I said, let's try Imodium, because I actually realized I was surprised that she hadn't been using Imodium. And when she added in, loperamide, so I'll use the generic names. And when we added in the loperamide, she said to me afterwards, the next visit follow-up, she said, I can't believe no one has told me to do this before. And all of a sudden, she thought I was amazing. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I did such a simple, low-risk, you know, just very simple, low-cost intervention, not using a high-risk medication or anything, and it had such a dramatic improvement on her symptoms. She said, I can leave the house, I can go out, I can do all the things that I want to do, and it dramatically reduced her bowel movements. It was such a powerful thing, and I was thinking, wow, I love low-tech things. I love when something low-tech works really so well. So loperamide can improve bowel urgency. That's caused by both inflammatory and non-inflammatory mechanisms. It also normalizes colon transit time and whole gut transit time, and it's thought to increase internal anal sphincter tone as well. So again, you know, this may be a low-risk and intervention that you might be doing. I like to time my antidiarrheals. I don't know if how much it can work just by taking the antidiarrheals, of course, but I like to time them to about 20 to 30 minutes before eating, especially if they're having postprandial urgency or diarrhea even, and that really seems to work quite well.
No, I agree, and I think that it's something that I don't know if anyone's ever actually like read the boxes of these at the grocery store, but on it it says should not be used like, you know, chronically. And so I always tell my patients that's because we don't want people using these and not getting a diagnosis. Yeah. You have a diagnosis. We are managing your Crohn's disease. This can be used chronically and daily. There are no untoward effects associated with that. So sometimes the patients need that reassurance because they think, oh, I shouldn't be using.
Great point. Yeah. It's a really great point, and actually it's an important point because it's true that they'll say, well, I only took it for a few days and then I stopped because it said that. And so I agree with you. I usually do say this can be taken long term, but I also include in there what the maximum is per day, and I also include do not take it if you don't pass stool or you feel like you have to go to the bathroom and you can't go to the bathroom. So I think just putting in some caveats for the patients that I just include in my after-visit summary for them along with the instructions on how to take it is helpful. So in looking at a study, and I think that what was interesting about the study, this is an older study looking at patients with Crohn's disease using loperamide. They were given an initial dose of 2 milligrams, and then they were asked to take 1 milligram after each unformed stool. And even just doing something simple after 1 week to see, well, how did this work? Both the investigator and the patients both saw improvement in their global efficacy. So they were significantly better with loperamide compared to those who were taking placebo. Not surprisingly, but it's, again, just a very simple intervention that can have, you know, profound effect. After the second week, both responders to the first week, they continued to use 1 milligram just twice a day. So not a lot of, I would argue, not a high dose. And both the investigators and the patients saw that efficacy and symptoms were really quite in favor of using loperamide. Another option can be tricyclic antidepressants. I think that we use tricyclic antidepressants probably historically when it comes to abdominal pain, but it's great to know that this is an option as well for urgency. So there was a study done looking specifically at idiopathic fecal incontinence. Small number of patients, but the really wonderful feature here is that the urgency was improved after just 4 weeks. So this used amitriptyline 20 milligrams a day for 4 weeks, and at the end of those 4 weeks, the patients with the idiopathic fecal incontinence really saw better results. No soiling. I think this was actually a really interesting piece of the puzzle. No soiling or urgency of defecation to both solid and liquid stool, which is actually impressive because most of the time when there's solid stool, that might be a little bit easier to control, and the liquid stool may be much more difficult to control, and yet the amitriptyline was effective for both types of consistency, which is which can sometimes be a real challenge with the liquid stools.
I use this in my practice, whether amitriptyline or disipramine, which has a very good side effect profile. It's just an alternate tricyclic, and it can be dramatically life-changing. You only need a low dose, but it can really help when there's non-inflammatory mediated urgency.
And I think patients sometimes are really put off by this idea it's a tricyclic antidepressant until you explain that you really don't get into mood symptoms unless you're at, you know, high doses, which then the side effect profile becomes very unfavorable, and you know nobody would tolerate it really high doses, generally speaking. So it really can work well, and I agree some of the other side effects can be really nice as well in helping patients to get more rest. Is also the tricyclic antidepressants also had improvement in the rectomotor complexes also, so it decreases the amplitude, which is helpful. It also increases anal pressure, as you can see, and then in addition to that, the rectal pressure was decreased. So what you're having now is a better compliance of the rectum, which can be an important factor when it comes to urgency as well. So switching places now, this will be our third patient that we're talking about, is Henry. He's a 55-year-old male. He was diagnosed with Crohn's 3 years ago. He had no previous surgeries to Crohn's disease, but he had a prior cholecystectomy. He's on ustekinumab 90 milligrams every 8 weeks. Previously, he was on infliximab. And his current symptoms are fatigue, making it difficult to concentrate at work, bowel urgency, making it difficult to leave the house and be away from a restroom or eating, and after eating any food. Previous interventions he's tried, some of the standard ones that we've already talked about. He's tried loperamide, 2 milligrams after meals and 4 milligrams after meals with limited relief to urgency. He's also tried amitriptyline, 10 milligrams at bedtime for 3 months, and that was not helpful. And he also tried following a low FODMAP diet, and that he gave up after 2 weeks, which is not that surprising, actually. I think maybe in Southern California we might have more patients that are more interested. I think there was something that said the closer you are to like the LA area, the more likely people are to be like gluten-free and dairy-free and all of these other frees. But then, you know, you wonder what they're eating sometimes. So in this situation, you know, what's your plan for Henry? Well, let's look at some ideas. Going back again to the algorithm, so let's start at the very beginning and let's think in terms of, is there inflammation, yes or no? What are the labs looking like? So the great news is that you ordered a bunch of labs, so you order the standard labs, you order fecal calprotectin and CRP, and you're doing an infectious workup as well just to make sure that we're not going to overlook something like C. diff, which we know there's increased risk for in our patients with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis as well. And then we want to ask about other changes that have been going on. So what else is happening in his life? And I think Dr. Dubinsky mentioned this as well. So what else is going on the psychosocial platform that might be increasing all of this? Is there anxiety that's happening? Because we expect some of this, and that bowel urgency is playing a big role. So for Henry, and I loved this, the picture was so lovely and clear. Thank you for this great endoscopic picture. I heard this came from your practice, so thank you, Dr. Long. I was like, this is the one thing I said. I was like, sometimes the pictures just don't match what's going on.
You're not doing the scope yourself. It's important to have the picture.
It's important to have, oh my gosh, please, for all of your APPs out there, if you're a physician or someone who's doing scopes, please have great pictures and great reports, because I get to interpret those with my patient, and it's lovely to have great pictures. So you might notice here that Henry, the CRP is normal, the fecal calprotectin is normal, he does not have an infection, and his colonoscopy looks amazing. So this is really great. All right. So what would you do next for Henry becomes the question.
Well, I think you sort of showed it on the other slides. It's more to say that obviously you've ruled out mm-hmm. inflammation, mm-hmm. so now it's getting into these non-anti-inflammatory type of approach, and really keeping in mind, sort of as we noted, some of the diet, the meds. You talked a little bit about antidiarrheals already, but I think now let's dig into really other ways, bile acid diarrhea. There was a question around surgery. And mm-hmm.
Well, he'd had a cholecystectomy.
Yes.
And I think that's something important to remember, that even non-intestinal surgery can have a benefit with bile acid sequestrants.
Absolutely.
So, totally agree.
I agree. I think the two clues in his were the cholecystectomy and then the postprandial diarrhea as well. So those two things, I think, kind of give you an idea on what direction you're going to want to take and where you want to go down.
One other thing that I think is really important is, you know, obviously for women with childbirth, we think a little more readily about pelvic floor. Mm-hmm. But even in our male patients, there can be profound benefits to yes. pelvic floor physical therapy. And so I would just argue that we shouldn't be making it gender specific, that we really, really need to consider pelvic floor PT for our male patients yes. as well.
It's a great point, and we are going to talk about both of those.
So great. Oh, good.
Yeah. So bile acid malabsorption, this is an interesting piece, because there on the left-hand side of the screen, what you're seeing is under healthy circumstances. So in healthy circumstances, you have the bile acids that are reabsorbed by the enterocytes, and they are being delivered back to the liver. Only 3 to 5% of the bile acid should be excreted through the feces. And so that is going to be, that actually ends up promoting a positive immune response. And when you have that, the microbiota within the intestine are helping to convert the primary bile acids to secondary bile acids, which in turn helps to create a positive immune response or has less risk for a pro-inflammatory response. On the right-hand side is what we have, which is altered in IBD patients. So there's a couple of key points here on what's happening. So you have an altered epithelial layer, which now is going to create the ability for more bile acids to be to not be reabsorbed. And so you're having more excretion of bile acids, so that's going to induce diarrhea. The secondary thing that's happening is dysbiosis, which is another key hallmark as well within IBD. So you have decreased diversity. And in doing that, you have the less conversion from primary bile acids to secondary bile acids. And then that, in turn, is actually increasing a pro-inflammatory state as well. What's interesting about this next piece is this was a bit of a, I think this is really important, and you alluded to this already, actually, and you mentioned this, that we think about bile acid diarrhea probably in patients that have had resections, right? So in this particular study, they basically tagged bile acids with selenium, and then they went to see what happened, and as it moved through the colon, what happened at this point. What they found was that 90% of patients with bowel resections had high levels of bile acids. Okay, and then the next piece of the puzzle but was that almost 30% of patients who had not undergone resection also had difficulty with bile acids. And here again, it's like our patients with Crohn's are at higher risk for bile acid malabsorption than what we would think even without having a surgery. We mentioned already about rectal inflammation being a main cause of bowel urgency in IBD, or are thinking that it's a main cause, but we have to think in terms of all of these other aspects. So we touch on several of these. We've talked about, well, we didn't really talk about IBS, but that will be saved for another day. So there's only so much we can do, and I think we're running low on time. Bile acid malabsorption is the big one that we've just talked about now, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, poor rectal compliance, neurologic disorders, and then anal sphincter dysfunction as well. Mentioned about biofeedback. So thinking in terms of how compliant is the rectum and how can we think about assessing it. So there's number one, probably the most important thing, and for us, in our practice, we can't just refer to biofeedback. We first do an anorectumonometry study to assess. So that's part of the process. And on the right-hand side, you'll see like the four phases of the anorectumonometry testing, where they're testing at rest. So you're actually seeing how the sphincters are functioning at rest, the muscles are. The squeeze test, which is pretty self-explanatory. And then there's a push test. And then the last thing is the balloon fill, which I think for some of our, it's very important, I think, to explain to your patients what they're going to be asked to do during an anorectumonometry exam, because otherwise, if they're caught unaware when they understand there's going to be a balloon that's filled in their rectum that they're going to be asked to excrete, it can be awkward for them to not know that. So I do try to let my patients know that this is a normal part of the process. This is part of the test. And again, just to, I think I've said this a couple times, but trying to normalize this conversation just to make it more approachable and understandable, and that the physical therapists have, obviously, they have plenty of experience in this particular area. And then the next part is to come back to the biofeedback aspect. So once they have been evaluated and we know what is going on when there's pelvic floor dysfunction, dysinergia, and then to evaluate and actively exercise and retrain the muscles, retrain the brain-gut connection, the brain-sphincter connection. So strength training on the muscles. And this also, thinking as well in terms of rectal sensory training, so where the rectum can actually tolerate larger volumes, because sometimes what's happening is that the rectum is tolerating, it's not compliant, and it's tolerating these very tiny little amounts of stool, so you get a little bit of stool into the rectum, and then immediately they have a sense of urgency and have to excrete the stool right away, but then they'll say, I'm going this little tiny amount. So increasing this sensory training to tolerate these larger volumes and then to have a normal urge and normal urge sensation can be achieved. So that's part of this whole process. And then coordination of training is another piece of the puzzle as well. And over time, usually they don't need very many training biofeedback sessions to actually be able to achieve improvement. And it can be profound in what they're experiencing. And when the inflammation is under control, it's really interesting because the frequency of dysinergic defecation in IBD, not surprisingly, you might think of patients with a pouch and you might think, okay, patients with a pouch might be more actively maybe having higher rates of this. But then when you look also at patients, 45 to 97% of patients without a pouch are experiencing dysinergic defecation. And I think that piece is really interesting just to have it foremost on our mind. But when you look at an intervention like biofeedback, you can see 70% of the patients without a pouch will have improvement, and 86% of patients with a pouch will have improvement as well. So this can be a very effective technique to incorporate into practice also. Separately, there's pelvic floor training. So a lot of the our motility team teaches both the pelvic floor training and doing the biofeedback as well, but you can actually do pelvic floor muscle training without biofeedback. And that in and of itself can improve fecal incontinence. In 80% of the patients here, they actually saw improvement even in quiescent IBD. So it would be something useful for us to think about as well. I think in the sake of time, we'll kind of move through given where we are right now. There's other behavioral tailored treatments for individual patient symptoms. So there's pelvic floor muscle training, again, with or without the biofeedback, depending on what's available in your area. There's toileting behavior modification. So even just thinking about the timing in which they're going into the bathroom, not sitting on the toilet, cell phones, not bringing cell phones into the bathroom. I have talked with patients about, you know, please don't bring your laptop computer into the bathroom and work. And sometimes, because sometimes our patients saying, well, it takes so long for me to feel like you're emptied. But then there's, it really contributes to the problem when there's, when they're staying longer and longer and longer on the toilet as well. And then if there's lifestyle changes to think about, and having emotional support is, I think, a critical piece. And I think Dr. DeVinci's talked about that as well and how important that can be. So with Victoria, she was able to really identify ideal numbers of hours and shifts, length, and developing a work bathroom plan. So it was about what time of the day was better for her. So she really moved off the morning shifts, went to the afternoon shift, because for her, the morning was worst. She identified rescue interventions like we talked about, using social and family interventions, and then identified some bowel urgency. And that actually helped for her as well. Shared decision-making comes in a lot to these conversations. How do we approach this? How do we do it in a way that's approachable, that's comfortable, and that our patients really begin to kind of trust us and that we're building this repertoire of we're doing this together. We're here together. We're chatting together. We're making a plan together on what we think is realistic for what you can, what you're able to do. And by first, I think it's all about this asking the hard questions. We can have conversations about advising them, but we ultimately need to agree. Sometimes I'll say to my patients, are you buying the Kool-Aid I'm selling? It's like an old school, having grown up in the 80s, but it's old school discussion of, you know, is this, do you buy into this? Because we know that we've had conversations with patients in the past, and if the patient doesn't buy into whatever you're saying and they leave thinking, I'm never going to do that, you're like, what was that whole visit for? So I think these are all very important things in how we're kind of conceptualizing our conversations. And then making sure that they have time to come back. Sometimes they think it's a one-and-done conversation, and really that's not the case, that we need to come back, we need to see what works and what doesn't work, and we need to tweak and make modifications for next time.
Great. All right. Thank you. That was a tour de force, sort of helping us reframe, especially in Crohn's disease, think a little bit differently around urgency. So we're going to actually go back to our audience response questions and be able to see the pre and post. So again, which of the following assessments capture bowel urgency impact in patients with Crohn's? A, the Crohn's Disease Activity Index. B, the Harvey-Bradshaw Index. C, the urgency numeric rating scale, D, IBDQ, and E would be I don't know. So let's answer that.
I feel like we should change E to like phone a friend. I would think there's always somebody that knows. If I don't have the answer, I have someone I can call that maybe does.
Great. That is definitely meaningful change, so thank you. Mm-hmm. Essentially 100%.
100%. Mm-hmm. Can't beat that.
No. All right. Good question. Impact. All right. Second question, which is how often will you now, after this amazing symposium, how often will you incorporate bowel urgency assessments into your evaluation of patients with Crohn's disease? A, always. B, usually. C, seldom. And D, never.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's, you know, that's we wanted to show change that now that there's understanding about the fact that we have a tool to measure it. It measures something none of our other tools do measure.
Right.
And it's something that can be easily asked, 0 to 10. Mm-hmm. And it's really just remember it's how severity over the last 24 hours. But that does get to one of the questions, which is it available online? So we will go into the questions in just a moment and be able to address this. But first, let's just remember the SMART goals for this particular educational event and what we want out of it. And we want everyone to be able to proactively screen patients with Crohn's disease for bowel urgency using the NRS, the increase the percentage of patients with Crohn's disease who have individualized treatment plan to address bowel urgency during periods when inflammation is controlled. I think that, to me, is probably the most impactful part of sort of this discussion. Twofold. One is there's a way to measure it now, and it's different, and I can easily ask it because it's a simple question. And also now you've given some ideas, particularly in Crohn's, around ways to manage it. And the antidiarrheal question in the face of IBD, I'm going to come to you and how you explain the difference between Crohn's disease and the use of Imodium, for example, versus UC. I mean, yes, Crohn's versus UC, and improve the proportion of patients with Crohn's who identify personalized treatment goals for addressing the impact of bowel urgency, and that's that shared decision making. Mm-hmm. So let's get into the questions. I already posed the first one, which is around the urgency, the UNRS being available online.
So the tool is available. I mean, there's a specific form you can use, but in reality, you can actually ask, make a simple, you know, 0 to 10 scale, and patients can circle. You know, this can be a pre-visit survey, so it's something you can address. You can ask them during the course of the visit. You know, they can right there tell you if you had a scale of 0 to 10, mm-hmm. you know, how bad is your urgency in the last 24 hours? It's a very simple question to ask. And so I would encourage you, whether in the official, you know, format or just in that Likert scale in your clinic, that you could actually start using this when you go back on Wednesday.
A lot of our patients, we have the pain scale that uses that Likert scale, mm-hmm. right? And it has the smiley faces. And so you actually could use that in a similar, like, visual function or a visual manner as well to think about urgency.
Or on Uber after you've tried to get your refund, same happy faces. So the...
Yes, I will say, I mean, because obviously this was developed for the mirikizumab clinical trials, but it has been made available free. There's no proprietary, which is great to really allow for broad use for our patients.
And Lily's been very, very generous around it and granted copyright, so a lot of folks after the New England Journal article came out and we showed talked about the UNRS and multiple symposia and or abstracts along the way over the last, I guess, 4 or so years, I get a lot of emails asking about using it from pharma for other clinical trials, which
right.
is awesome. So that's really been wonderful. So, okay. So Millie, talk to the audience around where do you draw the line on antidiarrheals? What are your no go, because we did talk freely about it in patients with
right.
Crohn's. So,
right.
you know, we're often talking about toxic megacolon, don't use the antidiarrheal. So talk a little bit more about that.
Well, certainly in the setting of ongoing significant infection, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously C. diff is the obvious culprit here. We don't like to use loperamide or Lamotil. The idea being that can kind of enhance or worsen the risk from a toxic megacolon perspective. But remember, outside of the infectious components, these drugs are very safe. Like we really, once you've ruled out infection, I actually use this. I have seen benefit in both my UC and my Crohn's disease patients, particularly my Crohn's disease patients.
Yeah.
Who may use this a little bit more chronically. And ulcerative colitis, though, remember that even if you've had prior significant inflammation and that rectum is fully healed, they may still need, you know, an intermittent Imodium to help again with that internal sphincter, you know, contractility, to help slow things down enough for the consistency of stool, to have better continence. And this does not bother me. And I tell my patients, we're all used to using a lot of antidiarrheals in patients with pouches. Remember that you don't want to go more than 8 tablets in a day, but I've found that it really takes much less than that in patients when you're trying to target some of the urgency symptoms.
Along those same lines, Angeline, do you use Metamucil, psyllium husk, debulking? Because we didn't as much get into that.
I do love fiber for patients that will tolerate it. The consistency seems to matter, right? Like how the form in which you're using it matters, the type of fiber that you're using. So some of the clear fibers are, I tend to think of them as like the least potent, but the most tolerable sometimes. So, you know, I think of that, I actually think of it on a scale, and I'll explain this to the patients. You know, in the middle is the one that, I will have to say citricel because I don't know if anyone will know the generic name of it. And then on the more potent side would be psyllium or like the Metamucils, Fibercon, those ones. Our surgeons love those a lot, especially after pouches. So I think there's a lot of value to them. It tends to be polarizing though with patients. Like they either tend to love fiber or they
where it makes them bloated.
Yeah, it makes them bloated. So the trick, actually, I'm so glad you said that because the trick, especially with psyllium, so psyllium will certainly bloat patients or cause gas. Ask them to start it very slowly, like a quarter of the dose. If they start slowly and you give a couple of days to like tolerate it, to build that tolerance, and then you very slowly increase the dose, you will get there, and then they need to take it just consistently. So this isn't something you take on an, like you don't take it like one day and then you take it the next and then you don't and then you do. Take it consistently because you're looking for consistency with the bowel movement. So I think that that like slow titration effect really can be helpful when it comes to tolerating.
Okay, so four things, there's a couple of nice questions around starting tricyclic. Mm-hmm. Should you be working with psychology? Are you prescribing it? What happens when they stop it?
So right.
Go through that.
So in this scenario, I'm actually prescribing it because I'm actually not using this at doses that would affect mood. Remember that, you know, for example, 300 milligrams, which we would never use, might be a dose used 30 years ago for depression prior to, actually probably now 40 or 50 years ago. I'm aging myself. And so the doses we're talking about using are 10 to 20 milligrams of amitriptyline, or I actually really like using dazipramine in my practice, and you can even start at 5 milligrams. So I'm usually in that 5 to 20 milligrams. These are incredibly low dose, we don't see too much of the side effects. We're actually taking advantage of the anticholinergic properties to help basically form the stool more, and basically the side effects are the good effects, right? I do counsel patients about a little bit of dry mouth. You have them take it at night and, you know, start at a very low dose and work up very slowly. It can sometimes help with sleep, which is great, but if you start at too high a dose, they can feel kind of hungover the next day and feel a little too tired. But I've had fantastic benefits with this, that even a low dose goes a long way. Is it the same for you, Angelina?
Agree, definitely. And I agree, low dose, and you're just explaining all of those things that you've mentioned. And so either dosed at, usually at bedtime, but occasionally when they do feel hungover the next morning, sometimes I'll have them bring the dose closer even to dinner time, and that tends to fix that particular side effect or barrier to them using it. It generally doesn't take very long. I know that technically you say, like, we're going to wait, you know, you'll probably see max effect in 6 weeks or so, but usually within the first week or two, I find that my patients are improving it. And the reality is, you know, in the general GI practitioners, they're using these a lot for,
Exactly,
for IBS. So let's think about that and borrow that. So, and these are the same doses, so it should be a pretty comfortable segue to IBD.
Yeah, so would you say that if you have a patient with significant urgency, has inflammation, would you propose sort of a dual
yes.
approach, meaning it's a symptom that is very burdensome, you're managing, it's not going to get relieved right away. Are you working with your dietitian? Are you sending them for emotional support?
No, absolutely. A concurrent treatment can be really helpful. There's no reason you can't add fiber as you're treating their inflammation. There's no reason you can't do dietary modifications. The only thing I would probably hold off on is if they truly have an inflamed rectum, I probably wouldn't do a manometry, and, you know, at that time. But otherwise, all of these complementary aspects can still be of great benefit. And you don't want to make the patient, if it's going to take you 3 to 4 months to, you know, really heal their inflammation, you want to give them some ways to cope and improve the urgency even prior to that.
think really well said, because I think it's true. You don't want to make them wait for a solution. And I think I agree with you. And they're probably doing some of this already. You know, our patients love to do their own dietary changes, but they don't really necessarily know how to approach it, or they just don't eat. So I think giving them some actual helpful ways in which small things that they can do that are attainable can be really better.
Yeah, one of the questions was on bowel urgency remission definitions. Now, on the scale, zero means none, but it's not just zero. Zero, one.
Zero, one, yeah.
Less than two, sometimes equal to two. It varies, and I think and it also depends on the individual, so it is sort of hard to have a hard and fast rule around it. But zero or one would typically be considered bowel urgency remission, not just zero. It's just like zero or one is endoscopic.
Right, exactly.
Healing, whatever, the old term, but now.
And remember, patients can still have significant benefit just with a drop, you know,
3 points.
3 points.
Yeah.
So depending on where they start, that can profoundly impact their quality of life.
Yeah, and I think looking at the bowel urgency outcome within MIRI as well for Crohn's will help us sort of understand that as well. And then there was a few questions, believe it or not, on jury duty, which I think is a very good question, or, you know, it's not just jury duty, there's other parts of our patients' lives. So there was a question on whether or not it's a reason for excuse from jury duty.
So I have written those letters, because if a patient can't exactly in the middle of a trial get up and run for the bathroom, and it has become incredibly anxiety provoking for patients to think of being stuck in that box.
Mm-hmm.
And so there actually are letters even on the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation website for like accommodations. And so I definitively had said they have an inflammatory bowel disease, they may need urgent bathroom access, they need to have, and typically that does excuse them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously we all want to do our civic duty, but I think that this is a very valid rationale for why they couldn't be sitting in the jury box for 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
Have you done the same?
I have, actually.
Yeah.
Similarly, we can't excuse them. It's not a permanent excuse. It's usually just a deferral. But it often will give time enough that then we can start implementing. Because if you haven't talked to them about the urgency and then all of a sudden they ask you, you know, usually it's through my chart, please fill out this form for me. And then you're realizing, like, I think we should have a visit. Let's talk about this and let's actually implement some things. I'm hopeful that we're going to implement something that's going to help them so that, you know, maybe they do need one or two deferrals, but by the time they get back, it usually takes a couple years before they're called up again.
In a comparable matter, I take care of a lot of college students at the University of North Carolina, and I always actually encourage them to register for accommodations, because it's the same thing. You're in the middle of a test,
yes,
and you've got to get up and, you know, use the bathroom urgently. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, this can affect a lot of different areas where you would hope, and in my experience, the institutions have been accommodating, and it helps the patient. I think it relieves some of that anxiety that they know that these accommodations are in place, and that has helped.
The same for work, right? There's
right.
a question around the employer and how do you discuss
right.
this. And that's why when you look at work productivity, absenteeism, presenteeism, mm-hmm. it's a real mm-hmm. problem for our patients. And we know that an urgency plays a major role. So I want to thank you both for your insights into the audience and to the questions that have come in. They've been really helpful, and I think it's hopefully going to impact when we all go back to the clinic on Wednesday, Wednesday,
yeah,
Thursday,
exactly.
Whatever our next
whichever day, we're going back.
Day, we're going back. We'll be able to impact those lives, which is really what we're here to do. So to assess this, to learn more, scan the QR code here to access additional educational resources. As related to this event specifically, it will be available on Gastroenterology Hub on the CME Outfitters website, which also has additional resources for clinicians and patients. And as noted, thank you to the audience, thank you to those virtually, mm-hmm. and hope you have a great day today at DDW. So thank you.
Thank you.